This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. He's a world-acclaimed author, speaker, professor of geography, evolutionary biologist, and Pulitzer Prize winner. His book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, is a worldwide bestseller, which argues that geographical and environmental factors shaped the modern world. Dr. Jared Diamond is on the phone with Thane Maynard this morning.
Dr. Jared Diamond, thank you for taking a few minutes to be with us.
Gladly. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the show. I've been a great admirer of your books for many years, and your new book is terrific. Tell us about some of the response you've been getting.
Sure. Well, people have been interested not just in the fascination of traditional societies that do things so different from ourselves, but also in the practical lessons for what we can do. And I would say that the areas that people have most glommed on to for their lessons are how to raise children, how to treat old people, how to avoid dangers, and how to stay healthy. Those are the four main areas.
And for listeners not familiar with the book, the title is The World Until Yesterday and explores a lot that we can learn from traditional societies. Now, when you say traditional societies, tell a bit about how far back you're looking, because you're not necessarily to the Stone Age, right, but to traditional societies you've experienced.
Well, yes to the Stone Age, and yes to the ones that I've experienced.
Exactly.
The human line arose about 6 million years ago, but the earliest humans were essentially glorified apes. And so my book is about the traditional societies that have persisted into modern times, for example, in New Guinea and in the Amazon, and the ones described by travelers for the last several hundred years, and then also the ones that we know about through archaeological investigations over the last 10,000 years. So just to go back to what you said, yes, traditional societies include Stone Age societies using stone tools, but there were also modern traditional societies that had metal tools.
So you mentioned a couple of the highlights that people have hooked up with. Tell a bit about this issue of raising kids, because that's a challenge to anyone who's in the process or has been in the process of raising a family.
Sure. Well, traditional people have to raise children just as we have to raise children. We raise children in different ways. Germans, Japanese, and Americans have different ways of raising children. And traditional societies, of which there are thousands, are basically thousands of different experiments in how to raise children. A generalization is that small-scale traditional societies of hunter-gatherers allow their children a lot more freedom than we do in the United States or Europe. The view that they hold is that a child has got to make its own decisions, it's eventually got to be on its own, and it might as well start early. So even babies and young children are given a lot of freedom to make their own choices. And I've seen this in New Guinea with 5- and 10-year-old New Guineans, kids, negotiating with me and taking jobs with me without discussing it with their parents.
And that's certainly contrary to the way we're doing it now in America, where between helicopter parents observing their children in their 30s and what they're doing or helping pay their bills, we might not actually be helping.
That's right. We micromanage our kids. On the one hand, we want the same outcome that New Guineans do. That's to say, we want our kids to be independent and able to make decisions and socially skilled and precociously mature and all that stuff. And then you look at what we do to our children, which is we schedule them, we micro-schedule them, we tell them what they're going to do at 3:30, at 4 o'clock at soccer, at 4:30 at piano lesson. They don't have any choices. And so when they get to be teenagers and they finally have to start making choices, they haven't had experience doing it. And so it's no surprise that our kids have teenage crises, and even as adults in their early 20s, they often have difficulties making decisions.
Absolutely. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you mentioned some of the ways that old people either are revered or are involved in early societies.
Yes, there it covers a spectrum. The treatment of old people in traditional societies can either be much crueler than in modern society, or more often, much more satisfying. Where it gets cruel is in traditional societies that are nomadic, that shift camp, or that periodically have food shortages. And those societies just don't have any choice except to abandon or actually kill or encourage to commit suicide their old people. Sounds terrible, but What can you do if you're going to shift camp and you just can't carry an old person who can't walk? More often, though, in sedentary traditional societies, old people have a much more satisfying life than in the United States, because they're living in the same place where they've spent their lives. They're surrounded by their relatives, their children, their lifelong friends. And so the phenomenon of loneliness that's such a big issue for old people in the U.S. doesn't exist. And old people have an important value in traditional societies. They're the repositories of knowledge, whereas nowadays Americans who want to know something don't find an 82-year-old, but they look it up on the Internet or they Google it.
Exactly. No kidding. Now, a thing I've always been curious about, because your books are highly popular, very popular with me. In fact, your book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, is on what I call my desert island bookshelf of my top 12 books. And yet sometimes I know among professional anthropologists that you have some critics. So tell a bit about that.
Well, if I didn't have any critics, it would be because I've written a boring book. The Bible has its critics.
There you go.
It's specifically an issue for scholars like myself, so people from universities who mostly spend their careers writing technical papers for the five other experts in their field. Mm-hmm. I was an expert in gallbladder physiology, and I wrote very detailed papers with precisely defined terms about gallbladders that got read and praised by the world's four other gallbladder experts. Well, that's what one is trained to do in universities. But then if you go and write for the general public doesn't want specialized gallbladder terms. It wants language that it can understand and issues that can be understood. Because my mother was a school teacher and I had a younger sister whom I was always having to explain things to, I'm accustomed to explaining things to people. But when a university professor who's been spending his or her life using precisely defined language, when that person encounters someone writing for the public, it's like violating what you've been told to do all your life.
Well, but the books really are terrific. A number of years, The Third Chimpanzee, for instance, obviously be of keen interest to a zoo director. Speaking of which, just as we might be losing a little bit of the knowledge that's in traditional societies, the same way I have always been amazed at your background, as you said, in medical physiology, of course, now a professor in geography, but also a bird expert of international renown. So in many ways, you're a biological renaissance man.
I'm interested in lots of things. I got interested in birds when I was seven, and I was lucky that my parents and my school encouraged my interests. All of us start out young with lots of interests, and most of us, particularly those who go into scholarly careers, end up specializing. I've been lucky that I've had support of universities that have permitted me to pursue all these interests, and then I have this wonderful public that reads my books and tells me when I've got it wrong and corrects my understanding.
Tell me this. I've always wondered ever since reading Guns, Germs, and Steel, how many languages do you speak?
Well, at one time or another, I've spoken or written 12 languages. At present, there are only four languages that I'm sufficiently fluent in that I can give speeches in them. That's English, Italian, German, and talk pidgin. I used to be good at French, Spanish, and Russian, but I'm now very rusty. I used to read, but I never spoke Latin, Greek, and there are several other languages that I spoke in more rudimentary fashion.
Well, that certainly plays to the point of you being both a Renaissance man and really gifted at telling this story. A thing I loved about your new book, The World Until Yesterday, you had a lot of personal stories in there as well of your adventures and misadventures in New Guinea.
Yeah, I use these personal anecdotes to illustrate points that scholars have studied in people around the world. For example, scholars have talked about dangers. What are the dangers that people encounter in traditional societies? Well, the dangers include crocodiles and starving and war. Nowadays in the United States, we're not so worried about crocodiles and starvation and war, but we still face dangers that we don't think clearly about, whereas traditional people have to think clearly about dangers because they can't call 911 or call the doctor. And so I realized through my work in New Guinea that I really had to pay attention to slipping in the shower and slipping on the sidewalk and slipping going downstairs, because that is a major killer and crippler of older Americans. And so yesterday, my wife and I were going up and down stairs in a hotel, and we held on to the banisters, and we said, you know, whenever we go up and down stairs, hold on to the banisters, because failure to do that kills a lot of older Americans.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for taking some time this morning. I know you're busy, and I appreciate it a great deal, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to talk with you.
My guest has been Dr. Jared Diamond, author of the new book, The World Until Yesterday. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.